Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 35. Blood Flood. Rose. Rose bowed deeply at the end of her set as applause erupted and the crowd jumped to their feet. She gestured to her bandmates, guitarist Colby Frohlin, bassist Jamia Trellwood, and drummer Kravitz Horvath with sweeping arms. Rose smiled, feeling the rush of a successful performance as the Polaris diamond hung from around her neck. It seemed to buzz with energy against her chest. Her Compass Rose tattoo hovered above the top of the strapless dress, like an inky grayscale firework frozen in time at the top of its arcing flight path over the horizon. She let the sounds of clapping ring in her ears. She breathed in, letting the air disturbed by the applause fill her lungs. She and her bandmates walked off stage as the applause subsided and the lights gradually turned on. They waited for the audience to return to the reception hall for the post-event wind-down, where servers circulated with urbane desserts like macarons and other small pastries, sweet spirits like port and limoncello, and coffee in many forms such as nitro-whipped lattes and espresso. When she pushed through the velvet curtain to the backstage area, Easton waited by the exit. His warm smile appeared to be a veneer concealing an unusual sadness beneath his expression.
"As always, Rosebud, it was phenomenal,"
Easton pronounced to Rose and the band as they walked toward him.
"Thanks."
She glided toward Easton, still floating on her successful performance. Easton stopped Rose before she exited. The bandmates each thanked Easton in turn and walked past the two.
"Can I tell you something really quick before you go and enjoy yourself?"
Easton asked Rose.
"Absolutely,"
Rose confirmed. After a quick sigh, Easton looked at Rose.
"I don't mean to bring you down at all after such a magnificent performance, and I don't want to be too cryptic, but I have to say it. If something were to happen to me, I want to leave my most important assets to you."
"Easton,"
Rose started.
"No, seriously, please listen. I must tell you."
He took a breath.
"I have a normal will, but there are some special things outside of normal legal process that you must do for control of the Pyramid Club to pass to you. At any rate, I sent a hidden and encrypted message to your song program LD at home. If something happens to me, just tell the LD to play my favorite song and the video will activate."
Rose looked at Easton, puzzled.
"I'm not sure why you're telling me this right now. Is everything okay?"
He smiled, taking her hand with one of his and covering it with the other, the crow's feet near his eyes deepening as his eyes squinted.
"I'm fine. Everything is fine."
His face tightened into seriousness again, and she could feel the tension in his hands as they held hers.
"Tell me what you need to do if something happens to me."
Rose looked at Easton, understanding the gravity of his request.
"I tell my song program LD to play your favorite song."
The tension in Easton's hand released.
"Thank you."
He exhaled a breath of relief.
"Okay, now go celebrate."
He released her hand.
"I'll see you out there in a few minutes. I've got to introduce you to some new members."
She nodded with a smile and walked through the exit doorway, still holding the door as she turned around and looked at Easton.
"It's the Pyramid song, right?"
Easton smirked slightly and nodded. Chapter 36. Another Light. Rose. The main reception hall simmered with vivacity as the club patrons conversed with each other after liberal consumption of alcohol, fine food, the prospect of increased riches, and Rose's musical performance. Trying to enter inconspicuously, Rose slid sideways through the hallway door into the reception hall. It never worked. Heads turned toward her like a ripple across a placid lake. The attention made her feel shy and self-conscious, even knowing full well that she just performed confidently in front of these same people. Her bandmates already had drinks in their hands as they smiled and chatted. A server ambled by, so Rose requested a fizzing flute of liquid gold champagne on the server's tray. She took a sip, feeling the chilled tang of the alcohol, which seemed to wash away any apprehension. As she tilted the glass back against her lips a second time, Rui Maier and Florian Silver approached her.
"What a wonderful performance!"
Rui exclaimed, one hand holding a cocktail with an orange peel corkscrewing around a sprig of rosemary, poking out from the liquid in the tumbler.
"Truly riveting. I was telling Florian..."
He gestured to the man beside him, who nodded and smiled.
"If you moved on from the club, I hope you don't. But if you did, you could make it big."
He pointed straight up with his free hand.
"Thanks."
She smiled.
"It means a lot to hear you say that."
"I'm not just saying that just to kiss your ass either. I'm serious. I've searched for your handles on the socials so I could follow you, but I can't find them. How are you so well hidden? You're a star. It should be easier."
Rose chuckled.
"I'm a businesswoman first, and this is my attempt at being a musician as a side hustle. I don't have time to curate a social profile."
"Attempt? Lady, you've succeeded many times over,"
Florian chimed in.
"I have to say, I loved hearing you do Amy Winehouse."
"I've been working hard on my Amy songs. I wish I could sing as well as she did."
"I'm telling you right now, you do. Trust me, you sounded brilliant,"
Silver declared. Rose reached out her hand and touched Silver's arm. From the crowd behind Rui and Silver, Easton emerged with a man slightly older than Rose.
"How did you enjoy the performance?"
Easton asked. The man he brought stood quietly next to him with a calm smile on his face and piercing eyes.
"We were saying to Rose how fantastic it was,"
Florian recounted.
"Truly memorable stuff."
"Glad to hear it,"
Easton said.
"Florian, Rui, you've met Jason, right?"
"Yes, we have,"
Rui said.
"We shared a table at the presentation and performance today, actually."
"That's right,"
Jason agreed, gaze transfixed on Rose. He seemed to regard her with familiarity, like they had known each other for a long time. She, however, did not recognize him. He was handsome and well-dressed, wearing a bespoke dark blue suit with white shirt and black necktie speckled with a fleur-de-lis pattern.
"Well, you haven't been introduced to our star performer. Time to meet her,"
Easton said.
"Rose, this is Jason Sola. He was recently referred to the club by Gio Mason. He's an attorney that wears many hats, and from what I gather, he's a whiz."
"Pleasure to meet you, Jason,"
Rose said with a smile. The ensuing handshake sent an unexpected electric jolt shooting through Rose's body.
"Great to meet you, Rose,"
he smiled, not severing the eye contact. The shimmer in his eyes reminded Rose of a person who found a buried treasure after years of searching. It made her feel simultaneously strange, at ease, and intrigued.
"I have to say, I thought I was the only person who knew the song Surfer King. Your rendition was majestic,"
Jason said. She still could not place how she felt around this man. Her eyes narrowed as she sized him up. The way Jason focused his attention on her in that moment made it seem like Easton, Rui, and Silver were hidden behind a fog that surrounded just the two of them. The result was that she felt an almost intimate closeness to him as he spoke to her, like she was the only thing in the universe that existed.
"Thanks,"
she responded.
"It's not that mainstream, but it's beautiful. Honestly, Jemaya should get the credit. It's her arrangement,"
she said, referring to the band's bassist.
"You should let her know you enjoyed it."
"Phenomenal."
The fog around them faded when Jason glanced at Easton. While Rose wanted to stay and speak with Jason, with whom she felt a strong connection, she knew part of her responsibility at the club was to mingle with other patrons.
"Excuse me, everyone. I have to continue my rounds,"
she said.
"But it was a pleasure to meet you, Jason."
He looked at Rose, and the intensity in his eyes spiked, locking on hers again, as if their eyes were coupled by a cable, and her gaze thus stayed likewise fixed on his.
"It was a pleasure to meet you, too."
He broke the intense gaze to give a slight head bow. He looked at her again as she smiled and walked away. Suddenly, she felt a premonition. It was as if someone had injected a faint memory into her mind. A familiarity she could not place, an absence suddenly filled. She did not know how or when, but this man she had just met would become an important factor in her life. Chapter 37. If only. Mac. On April 3rd, the Monday following his interrogation by Easton at the Pyramid Club, Mac walked into Esri's building furious, ready to rage at her for manipulating him. He had worn her gift, a jacket of alarm bells, into the highly secure Pyramid Club. Esri had treated him as an expendable lackey, and he had a much higher opinion of himself than she apparently did. He walked into the elevator, clutching his UD, knuckles white with the pressure of his squeezing hand on the device. When the elevator reached G. Esri's penthouse and the doors opened, Mac strode into the sterile white condo, swaggering past the security guard monitoring the door. Esri sat in her giant white leather throne, looking out over its armrest from her roost at the East River and the eastern part of downtown Manhattan.
Esri, what the hell?
Mac yelled.
You sent me in there?
He had not finished his admonition when Esri leapt out of her chair, pupils like black holes surrounded by her ringlet golden irises.
Shut your fucking mouth!
She screamed. Mac froze. She sped toward him, pointing an accusatory finger.
You're alive because I thought you might be useful.
Mac could feel his confidence receding. His plan to demonstrate his newly discovered self-assuredness was failing. Suddenly, she was toe-to-toe with him, looking up, her chin at his breastbone. She reached up, stretching her arm to its total length, and grabbed his throat with one hand and violently jerked his head down so his eyes were in line with hers. He gasped, spit gargling in his constricted throat.
Next time you speak to me, you treat me like God, or I'll put you down like a bad dog.
She let the words sink in for another second as she stared at Mac, golden eyes full of hatred. She released Mac's neck with a push, causing him to stumble backward, wheezing. He staggered, realizing that he still held his UD, which he was squeezing involuntarily. Esri's eyes jerked so they stared at the UD in Mac's hand. He slipped it into his back pocket as she gritted her teeth, still staring. Esri walked toward Mac, who was backpedaling. She reached in his back pocket and pulled his UD out, looked at it quickly, then held it in front of Mac's face.
This cannot be here. It's an operational security risk,
she stated.
Okay,
he coughed.
I'll turn it off and put it away.
That's not how this works. Do you know how easy it is to monitor what people say through a UD?
She paused as if waiting for an answer.
Do you?
She yelled.
I didn't know.
You are a stupid piece of meat, Mac,
she said accusingly, pointing at him with his UD.
There is only one way to deal with this situation.
She walked away from Mac and up to a table against the wall. She made a show of deactivating the UD so Mac could see that she gently and deliberately placed the UD on the table. With her back to him, Mac saw the same enormous chrome pistol she pointed at him at Disco Ardent less than a week ago sticking out of the rear waistband of her pants. At that moment, she pulled out the pistol, turned to Mac, raised her eyebrows, grabbed the barrel of the gun with her hand, and violently smashed the UD with the butt of the gun. Once. The sound of tempered glass shattering accompanied the small metallic clinks of the UD pieces raining musically onto the white tile floor. Twice. Mac twitched, watching his most important possession transform into a twisted square. Thrice. After the three blows, the UD looked unrecognizable.
I love technology,
Esri said, looking at the gun in her hand and then at the smashed bits of UD on the table and floor.
This gun is an elegant invention. Through simple mechanics and chemistry, it can shoot a projectile that can rend flesh and end life with the press of a trigger.
She cooed.
The most impressive technologies in existence are not complex. No, it's the simple stuff.
She held up the pistol.
Not UDs, sophisticated networks, self-driving cars, or Vizzies. Not even Branch.
Lifting her shirt and sliding the gun into her waistband, Esri turned around and looked at Mac with a calm smile and inquisitive eyes.
What were we talking about?
She asked. Before Mac could respond, she continued.
Ah, yes. You were telling me more about the networks of the Pyramid Club.
Yeah.
Mac stammered, voice raspy. Esri walked casually over to Mac, pushed up onto her tiptoes, and put her arm around his shoulders in a pretend showing of friendly affection. She was so short he had to bend his knees to accommodate the gesture.
I handmade that jacket for you. Custom.
Her eyes widened with excitement.
Beyond being fucking gorgeous and fitting you perfectly, I fashioned it with special care.
She posed as if she had been struck into a heroic marble statue.
I took processing units, RAM and solid-state disk units, rolled them into spindles, and wove them into the fabric along with remote transmitters. I'm like a modern Arachne.
She giggled.
Then I coded a program that would scan the network's defenses and that I could run using the spindle hardware I created. During the scan, if a vulnerability were discovered that could be exploited, the program would penetrate and spread through the network with a specially tailored malware of my own design. It would encrypt the network and exfiltrate a copy of its data to me. Quick and dirty.
Genius,
Mac thought. He had been an inside-out Trojan horse.
Did it work? Did you get anything?
I asked. Ezri swung her hand up and slapped Mac across the face with an audible thwap. Mac drew back, shocked at her capricious attack.
My Transcendent and Empyrean skills did not fashion some shitty, ineffective program.
She glared at Mac.
It worked on Romstaller's network beautifully, and now he has no money.
He has no money?
Mac stupidly repeated her statement as a question.
Well, he has some money. Probably only like 20 million. People these days, they don't understand that their networks are insecure. My little program infiltrated Romstaller's network and found all his accounts. Predictably, most of them were set up for instant extra-high value transfers and API access.
Meaning they were linked together by a data pipeline allowing free exchange of information.
I didn't even have to bypass two-factor authentication or verify transactions. For him, instead of encrypting his network and exfiltrating his data, the malware cashed out all his stocks and derivatives positions. It sold other relatively liquid investments. All he has left is property. Even more fun, it turned off all push notifications to his UD about his finances, so he won't know about it until he gets a call from someone in a few days. Fucking idiot had default passwords and all his financial flows automated.
She giggled.
Then the program converted all of that liquidity to Bitcoin on Coinbase. It was wonderfully easy to do. Finally,
she continued, her voice gushing pride in her creation.
I did a poor job of laundering the money. I transferred the 700 or so Bitcoin to a private wallet address, making sure it would be easy to trace. The private address happens to be Rose's personal Bitcoin address.
But why?
Why?
Ezri asked in a mocking tone.
Why didn't you take the money for yourself? It must be a fortune.
Oh, honey,
Ezri said patronizingly.
I'm not motivated by money. Money can buy power, but I prefer power in a pure form. Even give or take $7.73 billion cash is not the kind of power I'm interested in.
She casually stole $7.73 billion?
Mac thought to himself.
Now Romstaller has no leverage over anyone, and he has a reason to hate Rose. That should make him easier to recruit to do dirty deeds for me. Dominion over people, not money, is power. You should understand that at this point.
So Ezri has given Romstaller a reason to go after Rose.
Mac's mind raced at the thought of the value of Ezri's heist.
My God.
Mac exhaled.
It was brilliant if I do say so myself. Unfortunately, my attempt to penetrate the Pyramid Club failed because, unlike Romstaller's, its network has impressively airtight security.
She withdrew to herself and paced, now fully concentrating on her explanation.
It's an advanced network. It leverages massive compute power, and its electricity consumption is akin to that of a small city. Reminds me of a cluster of quantum computers, or an industrial-scale server farm.
She stopped pacing and looked up at Mac. Her irises shined like golden disks. Mac scratched his head, confused by the technical jargon. Her mouth then curled into the maniacal smile that he had seen numerous times recently.
I think there's a fucking supermassive AI running out of the club, and we can steal it.
Okay.
Mac's eyes narrowed.
Now, tell me more about what you've learned.
Well, I haven't seen any evidence of AI or quantum computing.
He squinted, trying to locate relevant visual memories in his mind's data pool.
Although, the Song Program LD has a digital home assistant called Song. I don't know how sophisticated it is, but it reminds me of Cortana or Alexa. You remember those sad excuses for AI? I have a feeling it's just window dressing for the program, rather than anything truly functional.
I fucking knew that already,
Ezri blurted. She looked at Mac again.
Give me more!
So security latched onto me as soon as I entered the club. The guy who runs the club, Easton, grabbed me before I even really entered the main reception hall for cocktail hour.
I wonder how he knew.
Ezri frowned.
He seemed to just know.
So this guy, this fucking Easton, he's the one who controls the security system. I don't know what it is, but I'm fucking positive there is some kind of AI in that network.
She started pacing and verbalizing her internal dialogue again.
The computing capacity required to power such a thing is hard to comprehend, but this club seems to have qualities that suggest AI, though it would require more than several dozen warehouses full of servers.
She froze in place.
It makes sense now. The decentralization, the web of interconnected song program devices. It's like the smaller devices buttress the computing power for the centralized entity and provide decentralized storage for shards of data.
One of the major investments made by the club several years ago was QuantCat, the quantum cloud infrastructure company.
That's how they do it.
She nodded vigorously.
That's it. The main node of the network is at the club, but it must use QuantCat for additional power.
How could you possibly find out with certainty?
Mac asked.
It would be difficult to detect, it's true, and it'd probably be even more difficult to take control of, but there must be a way.
Ezri's eyes squinted in concentration.
I want it.
Her eyes widened, and it seemed like her golden irises swelled into the corneas.
I want it,
she repeated through her teeth.
What about the diamond?
It was all he needed to obtain to be free of Ezri. Ezri shot Mac a piercing look.
You'll still get me that diamond. But I'm a businesswoman, and we're pivoting. Obtaining that diamond is now a part of our new objective, a hostile takeover of the Pyramid Club, with the goal of accessing and controlling its AI.
Mac gulped. His throat hurt. He started to feel as if his agreement with Ezri was in a state of flux. He needed assurance that she would follow through.
Ezri,
Mac said in a pleading voice,
how do I fulfill my part of our bargain?
She looked at him again. Like a parent looks at a child who asks a vague question.
Well, Mac, my little doggy,
she giggled childishly.
Let's keep the agreement fair. You'll do what we initially agreed upon while simultaneously serving my broader goals. You'll get me into the Pyramid Club, and while I gain control of its networks, you will find the diamond. Then I'll release you once you put the diamond in my hand. I don't need you after that.
Okay.
Somehow he believed her.
We have to sit this Easton guy down for a little Q&A,
she said quietly. Chills ran down Mac's back like a cold drop of water that finally freezes at the bottom of an icicle.
It's going to be tough to get in. The doors are biometrically locked.
As he finished expressing his concerns, Ezri turned to Mac and cupped his face.
That's why I have you.
Ezri's saccharine smile was disarming.
Tell me more,
Mac continued.
The main entrance is open from the inside. There are cameras and probably other security features on the exterior of the club. The entry corridor usually has two security guards with guns, and there is a massive metal slab door, like a bank vault. It's between the entry corridor and the reception hall. It slides out of the wall like a pocket door, and is usually hidden in the wall, but I've seen them slide it in and out. If they seal that door before you make it into the main reception hall from the entry corridor, you'd be fucked.
Looks like we've got to move at a quick clip, which is fine because I'm feeling sprightly.
She giggled.
At the next event, you are going to open the door for me. You're my handsome little Trojan horse.
It registered in Mac's mind that Easton was a close friend of his father. The betrayal Ezri demanded he execute would be direct and overt. He risked destroying his own relationship with his father, but the weight of Mac's fear, twisted loyalty, or worship of Ezri outweighed his commitment to family. He knew that he was Ezri's instrument.
There's really only one way to overcome these obstacles.
She paused.
Cybersecurity's most serious weakness, relentless and brutal physical force.
She grinned like the caricature of an evil little girl who just received a living creature as a gift and was ready to sink her teeth into its neck. She lifted her hand, fingers arranged into a gun, and pointed them at Mac.
We'll just have to employ some old-fashioned, simple technology.
Chapter 38. Predicament. Easton.
I have new information,
Song said to Easton.
What is it?
Easton asked aloud.
Your instructions were to monitor Mac's actions through infiltration of his UD and branch. The objective was to conduct live audio-video surveillance to determine who or what motivated him to lie. I had been tracking his location, listening to his conversations, and exfiltrating recorded video footage. But suddenly, I lost access to his UD, and all audio and video collected ceased. That lack of access only occurs if the UD is physically destroyed.
What do you think happened?
I heard him call out Ezri, and then I heard the following.
Song played a recording of what sounded like a shrill female voice berating Mac and disparaging him by calling him a stupid piece of meat.
His branch data suggested that immediately before I lost connection to his UD, he entered a condominium complex with confidence, anger, and belligerence. Once he began speaking to this other person, however, his fear and anxiety spiked.
That's pretty brutal sounding stuff,
Easton observed.
Ezri. I wonder who that is. Ezri.
He trailed off while in thought.
It sounds like the person may be coercing Mac. Any information about who or what Ezri is?
This short exchange provided insufficient data to match the identity of Ezri with data points corresponding to a known identity in open source records. No matches anywhere,
Song said.
Additionally, Mac did not point the UD's camera at the person he was speaking with. After cross-referencing with location and other contextual metadata, no matches surfaced.
Under his breath, Easton cursed. The initial goal was to obtain leverage over Mac to extract information about the perpetrator of the suit jacket cyber attack. Instead, the information taken from Mac's UD caused Easton to feel fear for Mac. It sounded like he could be in danger.
Who could be doing this to him? What do you think, Song?
Easton asked aloud.
Does it sound like Mac is the fall guy for some criminal actor?
That is one of only several explanations of his behavior when I evaluate the totality of the circumstances. It seems he is in danger.
The possibility of Mac being the lackey of a violent criminal or fraudster concerned Easton, both for Mac's own safety and for the safety of the Pyramid Club, its secrets, and its members. Easton's thoughts turned to Geo. With the Mason restaurant empire suffering financially and Mac's recent legal trouble, he worried for Geo's mental and physical health. Not to mention, Geo had been irate about Easton's detention of Mac.
I'm going to call Geo and talk to him about Mac,
Easton said to Song.
I think I ought to tell him the truth.
He knew, when speaking to Geo, he could not specify how he knew the details of Mac's situation. He had been surveilling Mac's UD through the agency of Song, which constituted an invasion of privacy, a breach of trust, and a serious felony.
Do you want me to mark this call in your calendar for today?
Song asked.
No. Go ahead and dial him now for a video call. Geo is probably doing office work at this time of the afternoon.
Confirmed,
Song acknowledged. Easton pulled his desk chair forward and sat up straight, and then he placed his UD in a little charging cradle next to his computer tile screen. He arranged the windows displayed on his screen with his fingertips, so the video conferencing interface was in the middle, and he opened the privacy flap from over the lens in his video camera, which looked like a dislodged eye stuck above the monitors. His own face appeared in the bottom corner of the video conference application. Suddenly, Geo's face filled the picture.
Easton.
Geo was frowning slightly.
Good to see you, Geo.
Why are you calling?
He is usually an exemplar of courtesy and hospitality,
Easton thought.
He must still be upset with me. First, I wanted to say I'm sorry for what happened with Mac at the last Pyramid Club event. I should have approached the situation more delicately. I was disturbed at the discovery that someone or something was attempting to gain access to the Pyramid Club network. I let the panic get the best of me.
The lines around Gio's eyes relaxed.
Thank you,
Gio responded in a buttery, smooth tone.
I was livid at how you treated Mac. I know you gotta protect the club, but next time, approach me first.
I made a mistake. I'll consult with you next time. You're a close friend. I don't want to upset you. Again, I'm sorry.
I appreciate that.
That's not the main reason I called, though.
Easton's response was quiet, a slight downturn in the corners of his lips as he spoke. Gio raised an eyebrow. Easton filled his lungs with a deep breath, and his words tumbled out like leaves on a gust of wind.
I am fairly certain that Mac is involved with criminals, a hacker or cyber criminal specialist.
The two men looked at each other silently through the screen.
I didn't know what the best way to tell you was, so I'm just saying it.
What do you mean? How do you know?
Gio asked, voice raised.
The signal we found came from the jacket, not Mac. Although he didn't seem to know he was doing anything wrong, he appeared to be hiding the identity of the person, or whatever, that gave the jacket to him.
If you're operating on a hunch, it's not good enough, Easton. You'd need something more concrete than, I think he was lying to convince me that Mac is up to no good. He's put that bad boy lifestyle behind him. His criminal case instilled him with the fear of God.
Easton thought about the scene recorded by Mac's UD that Song had shown.
I'm concerned about his safety. If someone is threatening him to hurt him, or worse, I figured you'd want to hear about it.
He stopped for a second, contemplating the best way to continue the conversation.
Does Mac seem to be himself right now? What I mean to say is he acting strangely.
Gio's eyebrows angled down his nose in anger as he slammed his desk with a fist, the crash of pinky ring on wood making a loud crack.
Damn it, Easton! You apologize for how you behave and then talk to me like you're blaming my son for the exact thing you were apologizing for. Your accusations are getting on my nerves. He isn't being threatened. If he were in trouble, he would tell me. He hasn't given the slightest inkling that he needs help.
Easton lifted his two hands in a gesture of surrender.
This is on me. I pushed too much. I'm sorry.
My son has problems, no doubt, but he's past his criminal bullshit. He's returning to the family business so he can help me lift it back up. He's an excellent businessman when he isn't distracted. He's getting back on track.
I can't win this battle,
Easton thought.
If I persist, I'll lose the argument and a friend. I'm eager to see him get back into the industry,
Easton said, in as lighthearted a tone as he could muster.
He hasn't been able to meet me for months, but we are having dinner in a few days at Atavica. I'm going to tell him my plan for getting our restaurants here in the city back to their cosmic rankings.
Gio's anger dissipated entirely after talking about Mac. To Easton, he seemed to be blinded by his love for his son.
Do me one favor, Gio, please.
The question snapped Gio out of his pride-induced trance.
What is it?
Just tell him I'm worried. I think he's being coerced. Ask him about it. Blame it on me, but please ask him. It will put my mind at ease.
Easton sighed, eyes downcast, and shook his head.
Truly, I don't want to anger you. You're my friend, and I'm just trying to do right by you.
Gio's countenance softened.
You don't give up, do you?
Gio chuckled.
Well, I guess that's why you make a good businessman and why the club runs so smoothly.
He sighed.
Yeah, I can do that for you.
Thanks, Gio. I owe you each a pour of rare champagne. I hope it will make up for my behavior.
Gio nodded slowly with a lopsided smile.
Make it a 1990, and we will call it a deal. You do have marvelous taste in champagne. I'll give you that.
Deal.
Gio leaned forward into the screen and started fidgeting with the controls on his computer.
Take care.
You too,
Easton replied. Gio's face disappeared into a window of black on the screen.
I hope that Gio can figure out what is happening with Mac,
Easton thought.
I wouldn't want whatever pressure he's under to cascade into problems at the Pyramid Club.
Chapter 39. Wavelength. Romstaller. Sitting in his favorite leather armchair looking out over the river, Romstaller gazed over the Brooklyn skyline from his seaport penthouse, feeling like a duke presiding over his domain. His UD rested dormant on the arm of the leather chair. Suddenly it illuminated, awakened by an incoming call. Romstaller blinked his thought-lock code into his mind's eye. Ampersand. Green. Rooster. Billion. Green square. Then inserted his ear-dot hands-free earbuds and answered the call.
Yeah.
I'm Romstaller?
The voice on the other end asked.
Who's calling?
This is Marianne Wilkers, client account management specialist at Lux Hills Finance Group, Mortgage Services Division.
She said with perfunctory politeness.
We are calling about your mortgages.
I don't have time for this right now. Just call my accountant. You have his number. You don't need me to...
Sir, you don't understand.
She interrupted.
You're in arrears for failure to pay your mortgage on your New York condominium, your Hamptons Beach house, and your Mulholland Drive home in L.A.
Bullshit!
Romstaller exclaimed.
These mortgage processes are all automated. I haven't heard from a human being in a fucking age. Are you a scammer or something?
Sir,
the woman said. Her voice sounded strained.
As an account management specialist, if automated notifications are disabled and an important issue arises, I call the client.
She exhaled sharply.
Your monthly payments were drawn on accounts with insufficient funds.
Romstaller shot out of his chair, anger spreading through his body.
What the hell did you just say? Insufficient funds?
Yes, M. Romstaller. Whatever accounts are linked to your mortgages lack the funds to make payments.
I know what insufficient funds means.
He kicked his leather armchair, which toppled onto its side. Through a command to Branch, Romstaller terminated the phone call.
The Pyramid Club, and now this!
He thought, bristling with rage as he marched, red-faced, to his office. He commanded Branch to conjure up his unified investment dashboard on his UD, which showed all his investment accounts, bank accounts, and cryptocurrency accounts. Each account had three simple digits with a decimal. 0.00. He stopped walking. His mouth opened, and he stared incredulously at the surface of his device.
This can't be.
He blinked the command for dialing the emergency mobile device of his personal wealth manager. The UD rang its neutral patient tone in his ear as he impatiently paced in his condo.
Hello?
The voice on the other end answered calmly.
Tanner,
said Romstaller, stating the name of the other man on the line.
What the fuck is going on?
Romstaller,
he responded.
It's been a while. How's everything?
Before he could complete the question, Romstaller interrupted.
Just shut the fuck up and listen.
He commanded brashly.
What is happening? My account is drained, and my automated mortgage payments didn't go through. It's gotta be a fucking glitch, right? All my accounts show zero.
The man on the other end of the UD cleared his throat.
I don't know. Let me take a look.
You don't know?
Romstaller barked.
How the fuck don't you know?
I'm sorry. Give me a second to see if I can figure this out.
How did you lose all my money? You're my personal money manager, for fuck's sake. I give you wheelbarrows full of dough, and you have access to all my accounts and revenue streams. I expect you to figure out what's going on.
Give me a second, I'll look at your accounts.
Hurry up,
Romstaller snapped.
I'm looking on the back end. Looks like you had APIs in place,
Tanner said, referring to Application Programming Interface, the term that describes digital pipes that allow data to flow freely between different applications, web pages, or software programs.
And?
Romstaller barked.
These APIs allowed you to access all of your accounts from one program, your unified investment dashboard, and it allowed for near instant movement of large sums. Your security measures were substantial. You had two-factor authentication, facial recognition protocols for login, all that stuff. I'm seeing dates and times that someone logged in, but it looks confirmed by facial recognition.
I haven't accessed my accounts in a few months, so it sure as shit wasn't my face that was detected.
He paused as the realization hit him.
I'm hacked!
Tanner cleared his throat.
Looks like someone managed to bypass your security features, allowing access to your accounts and push the transactions through.
Tanner took an audible deep breath and seemed to hold it, ready for a diatribe. Romstaller growled to himself.
How much?
Romstaller asked.
How much,
Tanner asked meekly.
How much did I lose?
7.73.
7.73? What the fuck does that mean? 7.73 what?
Billion? 7.73 billion?
Holy shit!
Romstaller said to himself. Tanner was silent. The resentment boiled in Romstaller's heart as he stared emptily down his hallway, processing the amount of money he had lost. He did the calculations in his head. It came out to about 80% of his total wealth.
I can't believe you let this happen, you goddamn cunt rash! You had access to all my accounts that had liquid assets, from Barclays to Santander to Goldman, and I got fleeced right under your incompetent nose, you fucking peasant!
There's nothing we could have done,
Tanner stated in a matter-of-fact tone.
The hell there wasn't!
Romstaller paced the office.
You have to fix it! Get my money back now!
There's nothing we can do.
What do you mean, there's nothing we can do? Reverse the transactions! Anti-fraud protection! Insurance! Do something!
There's nothing we can do. I've never heard of a hacker or cyber intruder with the capability to bypass so many security hurdles. They must have had administrative access to your network.
Romstaller restrained his anger, but it was about to bubble over like a simmering soup on a fire.
Are you saying it's my fault?
He asked in a restrained monotone.
I'm not saying it's your fault. All I'm saying is there is nothing we can do to get the money back right now.
Finally, Romstaller's inexorable fury exploded.
You get your best people on it right now to investigate this fiasco, and you get me my fucking money back, or I swear on Christ's skewered kidneys and on the heads of your children that I will sink you and your whole fucking firm.
He ended the call with a command to branch, his carotid pulsating. Fists clench, eyes bulging and red, Romstaller yelled until all the air in his lungs had escaped. He sat at his desk, which had a curved touchscreen monitor, keyboard, and scroll pad, and rolled his chair forward so his abdomen touched the desk's edge and aggressively swiped the screens in front of his face, causing the colorful windows depicting various charts and graphs on several investment platforms to bloom into view. In the sea of diagrams and summaries, what stood out to him was the consistent 0.00 as he scrolled. 0.00 in his bank accounts at Chase, Barclays, Santander, and Bank of America. 0.00 in his cryptocurrency exchange and decentralized finance accounts at Binance, Kraken, Bittrex, and Uniswap. 0.00 in his high-frequency stock trading account through Goldman Elite Banking. The list went on. A mix of anger and panic swirled in his mind as he stared dumbfounded at his screen. He had not received a single notification for any suspicious transactions. He could see that he had lost approximately $7.73 billion in assets, just as Tanner had described.
How the fuck did this happen? Where did the money go?
When he looked at his accounts page in the Unified Investment Dashboard, he could see that each of his account instantly transferred all his funds to cryptocurrency exchanges in his name, converted all the money from US dollars into Bitcoin, then transferred the Bitcoin out of his exchange accounts to private Bitcoin wallet addresses he did not recognize. He opened a cryptocurrency analytics platform called ChainSpector, included in his suite of investment software tools. ChainSpector allowed him to trace cryptocurrency transactions along any blockchain, which was like a permanent spreadsheet of every transaction ever conducted in that cryptocurrency. Since he cared about tracing Bitcoin, he selected Bitcoin for the cryptocurrency, and the analytic platform displayed a visualization of transactions in Bitcoin in a graphic user interface. Anxious and angry, he populated the ChainSpector dashboard with a complex web of transfers emanating from his accounts. Each transactional chain followed the same pattern. Funds left his exchange accounts, passed through numerous layers of disposable digital wallets, and then terminated at the same large white bubble. He recognized the wallet address. It was Rose's private Bitcoin deposit address, and it held 7,010.0243 Bitcoin.
Did she steal my fucking money?
Romstaller had seen the address listed on the song program, where patrons could tip in Bitcoin, Song, Ethereum, or other cryptocurrencies to the members of the Compass Rose Band. He did the math and saw that in the past day, a little over 7,000 Bitcoin, equal at that moment to approximately $7.73 billion, had moved into her deposit address. Rahmstoller rose from his chair, picked up his scroll pad, and hurled it at the wall, yelling at the top of his lungs. He stood, each breath he took fizzing with absolute odium.
$7.73 billion,
he thought. The person who benefited from this theft was Rose. He blamed her.
I can't go to the fucking cops because Easton could release the video of me if he knows I'm going after Rose,
Rahmstoller thought. He flagged Rose's Bitcoin address so Chain Spectre would notify him if she moved the funds. That might allow him to find her if she were trying to cash out by sending Bitcoin to a wallet belonging to a known entity like a bank or a cryptocurrency ATM. He had to find her. And when he did, he would take matters into his own hands and force her to return his funds. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.